The Capital Connection is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. David Gustina is the producer of The Capital Connection. Support comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.
It's the Capital Connection, and boy, am I happy this week because we have one of the favorite people that I just think is the best of the best, and that's Thomas DiNapoli, who is the controller of the great state of New York. It could be the Tom DiNapoli show. We could have you every week, and then I would feel good. How are you, Tom?
Well, after that intro and build-up, Alan, I'm doing great. Thank you, and I would be honored to do your show every week, but I know you have so many other interesting people you speak to that would not be possible, but thank you for the thought.
Well, as Pete always sang, newspapermen meet such interesting people. And my question to you is, how are the newspapermen and women treating you? Are they properly understanding the fact that you have this top job in New York State and that you might want to run for governor?
Well, you know, what I've been pleased about, you know, we've had a number of, significant reports in recent weeks on broadband, on the impact of COVID, on education, on the challenge we have with the money we owe to the feds and unemployment insurance. You go down a long list. And we do get good coverage on those reports. They don't always refer to Tom DiNapoli as state controller. Sometimes they say the office of the state controller, but that's fine with me because, you know, the team here does such a great job and they get the publicity. You know, I think politically, because Alan, as you could appreciate, I've kind of become the last person standing when you look at the number of folks that have come and gone during my tenure. So I think I've, in some ways, achieved a certain level of senior status, and maybe I get a little deference. I don't get beat up as much as I used to by some of the papers that used to like to take some pot shots. So I think certainly the coverage has been significant, especially anything we do with the pension fund. But the opportunity to really discuss issues, as you and I do on your show, I think everybody would have to acknowledge these kinds of forums are much more limited than they used to be. And I think that's unfortunate.
Yeah. Hey, Tom DiNapoli, I wanted to ask you a question. And no, it is not whether you have seen Madame Beerbaum lately.
I've been thinking a lot about her, though. I will say that.
Yeah. Just to catch our listeners up so that everybody knows what goes on here when we discuss this wonderful lady, is she was my French teacher at Hunter College in the Bronx, and also that of the famous political scientist, probably the best political operative who ever lived in New York, Norman Adler. And we used to take that class together, and he's a friend of yours, and we have discussed Madame Beerbaum in the abstract many, many times. But if anybody knows where she is, please let us know. It's alan@wamc.org. We'd love to catch up with her. So, Tom, I guess the question for you is, are you running for governor or aren't you?
Well, you know, Alan, we've talked about it before, and I'm honored when people ask. But, you know, I've been saying for a long time, probably 15 years, I've got the best job in state government. I still feel that way. And I think somewhat unexpected timing of the exit of the previous governor complicates a question like that. And I think, you know, for how I feel today in speaking with you, and I think how everybody should feel is that, you know, Kathy Hochul is now our governor. It's very important that she have a smooth transition. I think so far she has one. We need to move the state forward, and that means to support her administration and her efforts. So I would answer that question by saying, you know, for today, I'm not thinking much about the politics of next year, and I don't think anybody else should either. It's still September. There's many months before we go into next year. But I think, you know, at this point, I'm very, very pleased with the work we do here at the Comptroller's Office. And, you know, as I've said on your show before, I expect to be on the ballot next year. And, you know, I think, you know, there's always, we've learned in New York, things change overnight, you know, but at this point, it's nice to be asked, but, you know, I think the controller's job is suits me well. And you know, that's probably the path that seems the most likely.
Sure as hell suits me well to have you there. So let me ask you this. It's the year of the woman, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
We have a new governor. She's a woman, Kathy Hochul. We have other people who are thinking about running, Tish James and other people we assume she's thinking about running. Is this almost a guaranteed thing that whoever runs after Kathy Hochul's temporary 8 months are up will win because she's a woman?
Well, I think New Yorkers have celebrated the fact that we have a woman governor. And you're right, there are other names that are out there, obviously Tish James' name being the most prominent. But I do think you run a little bit of a risk, and in some ways, you know, you shouldn't minimize the talents of the individuals. You know, there's no, I know there's a whole, you know, thing about identity politics these days, you know, but I do think at the end of the day, assuming that there will be a primary, that the candidate that will emerge victorious will be the one that has the broadest appeal. Certainly, women candidates on the Democratic side have always fared well. I mean, you think of you know, Hillary Clinton's great success, and Kirsten Gillibrand has been, you know, reelected. You know, and we've had women lieutenant governors going back to Marianne Krupczak, who's living in Geneva, New York, and I you know, I'm in touch with, and she's a wonderful, wonderful role model. And I think, Alan, if I could volunteer, this underappreciated in terms of her role in the history of New York State, and I would recommend you have her on your show at some point because she has a lot to share about. Imagine running statewide as a woman in 1974, and you remember who she defeated in the Democratic primary on her way to being elected lieutenant governor, don't you? But you're not going to disclose that you know. A certain friend of yours who did your show regularly won Mario Cuomo and Assemblyman Antonio Olivieri. It was a three-way primary, and she won. So New York has a wonderful history, I think, of supporting women candidates statewide. Overdue to have a woman governor, and certainly, you know, with the two very prominent names of Kathy Hochul and Tish James out there, you know, there is certainly a strong probability that there could very well be a woman candidate heading the Democratic ticket.
We see now that the Attorney General and others have been attacked by the outgoing governor, Governor Cuomo, and there is a question as to whether the state should continue to pay the people who worked for Cuomo, including their lawyers. Can you explain all of that to us?
Well, it gets a little complicated, but in the most recent articles, you're seeing a change in direction from the new administration, where after a date, I think it's September 2nd, they are saying that they will not be putting in for, you know, support for the notion that the lawyers of folks in the administration that have been retained as part of this drama, that they will not be entitled to compensation, that if they want to seek compensation for legal fees from the state, they'd have to go through the process under public offices law with the Attorney General's office and get approval there. There are different categories of when legal fees and legal services are reimbursed for individuals when there's an investigation or someone's charged, which is different than an investigation. Under the prior administration, there was, let's say, a more liberal view in terms of request for legal services, and our office would look at the merits under the law of what would be allowed, and certainly there were a number of those payments that we did authorize, again, consistent with the law. But now that we have a different direction from a new administration, you know, that will not be the case. So it's a change of direction.
And if the new governor, Kathy Hochul, tells you, we don't want to pay for the legal defense for some of these people, you would be bound to listen?
Oh, well, we wouldn't have a request for payment if they wouldn't send it over. Yeah, exactly.
I see. Can you remind us what this is all about? Whose lawyers are being paid for here? I mean, Cuomo had some problems, like...
Yeah, well, and a number of other people in the administration. So I don't have the whole roster of names, but obviously there are many people that have been prominently mentioned in the news that have been under scrutiny.
Okay. Now, what about the GOP? I don't get it. They have a guy, Lee Zeldin, current outgoing congressman, and this is blue state New York, and he's basically a Trumper and a conservative. So what could they possibly be thinking? Is this because Trump's long arm says, I'm going to pick the candidate in New York?
I'm not sure that that's what it is, but there's no doubt that even in a state like New York, the impact of Trump on the Republican Party is significant. And, you know, look, Lee Zeldin was an elected official before he was a Trumper congressman. And in fairness to Lee, I know him from Long Island, you know, from my home base, although he's a Suffolk guy, I'm a Nassau guy. You know, he certainly has a reputation of being a hard worker. And for whatever reason, when Trump came in, he chose to follow that, you know, that part of the party line. I think to your point, I can't imagine that that's a successful track record to run on in a state like New York. But, you know, and I look, the Republican leadership, I have no insight into their thinking. They've coalesced early behind Lee Zeldin. There are other names, you know, Rob Astorino and some other names floating out there that are saying they would run a primary. We'll see if that would actually happen. It could be that it's just a political calculation, Alan, to play to the Trump base. It's not a big base, though, in New York. And you know, you got reapportionment, so you have a lot of possibility for Democrats to prevail, having even more seats in Congress. And their traditional power base in the state legislature and the state Senate, I mean, it's a far stretch to think they could recoup it anytime soon. But you know, at the rate they're going, I don't see them making too many inroads in the state Senate or the state assembly. So I don't really understand what their playbook is. You don't understand it. I don't understand it.
No, that's why I'm asking you.
Yeah, I don't understand it. No, I don't understand it.
You're far smarter than I am, but now Astorino is a fairly popular fellow. So therefore, I'm going to put it a different way, Tom.
Yeah.
I live in a very good state, Massachusetts. And in Massachusetts, I can be unenrolled as a voter. I can walk into the polling place and I say, I think I'll register now until I walk out of this place as a Republican or a Democrat and take a ballot in that primary. In New York State, we don't like that. We say you're a Republican or Democrat signed up or you don't get the vote in a primary. I think that's bad. What do you think?
I actually prefer how we do it because I think, you know, while you're right, most states have it the way you've described. But there is always the potential for people to, you know, pick their party in a given year. And I kind of feel people should choose their sides and stick to that side. We have made it easier to change your enrollment within a given year. It used to be many, many months. So you think you have to change your enrollment before the election in the current year to be able to vote in the primary in the next year. So we've changed that. So we've made it a lot easier if, in fact, you want to change your enrollment. But I think you should choose your side. You should vote in that primary of the side that you've chosen. And you have many people, as you know, increasingly that don't want to be in either party. And, you know, I mean, that's their prerogative. That's right. But I don't think that entitles them to pick and choose which primary to vote in. So I guess maybe because I've been, you know, in New York all my life and used to the system and been a loyal Democrat, I respect loyal Republicans. But you know what? Choose your party. Stick with that. But make it easier, as we've done, to change your party if in a given year, in fact, you know, you feel you want to vote in a different primary or you want to become enrolled in a party. So, you know, I the open primary, I don't necessarily think would be a good development, my opinion.
I hear you and I respect you. I just don't agree with you, but that's okay. Let me ask you this. The New York Times and Mary Trump are being sued by none other than Donald Trump for the bombshell story about the family's wealth and tax practices that was based on confidential documents she provided to the newspaper's reporters. So what do you make of that?
She's the niece that wrote the book, if I'm remembering correctly.
She is the niece.
Well,
yes.
I look, the Trump family psychology is something I also don't presume to be an expert on or, you know, whatever. I mean, Alan, I can't give you any insider commentary on that. It'll play out in the courts, however. Obviously, when there's a lot of money involved, it's not unusual to have litigation, right?
Right. Or if you have a bully involved, which Trump, I believe, is, and he sues people easily, you get sued. You got to come up with a lot of money to defend that suit.
Well, you also have the issue of an unwillingness to disclose information, right? I mean, it gets back to the issue of, you know, the tax returns and all that. I mean, you can't blame the Times for wanting to have reliable sources at all. I mean, that's their job. And if Trump had just released his tax information, as all other presidential candidates and presidents in recent years have done, you wouldn't even be having this. You may have other questions, but you wouldn't wouldn't have had this question.
Tom DiNapoli, do you have any sense on how much tax revenue the state has lost as a result of the Trump Organization's alleged tax dodges?
We have not calculated that, Alan. I can't give you a number on that. It would be an interesting question. I'm not sure that we could calculate it, but I don't have a number for you.
Okay. Let's talk about the Rikers Island jail. That's a jail I'd rather not be in. And everybody is talking about how corrupt, how mismanaged, how much violence there is there. You're the comptroller. You have to watch the money. What do you think?
Well, I mean, it's obviously been a horrendous situation for a long time. And, you know, under the current mayor, there's been the move to close Rikers and open up prisons in some of the other boroughs. That process has moved more slowly, probably, than the advocates for closing Rikers would like to see. You know, you saw the other day a delegation of state legislators visited and someone right in front of them tried to hang themselves. So, you know, you have for the inmates who are there, a horrendous situation, COVID making it all worse. And for the men and women who work there, you know, doing the corrections work, there are always stories about, you know, what they're subject to. So there's, you know, fair to say abuse all around. And, you know, the heightened attention coming from the state, hopefully we'll have some remedy there, more resources there for the safety of the inmates, for the safety of the people who work there. But there seems to be a very strong consensus that there needs to be a dramatic change in terms of either escalating the closure of Rikers or certainly doing something very different very fast there. So I know many are looking at this, and let's hope for some kind of strong action. What that will be, you know, I can't predict.
But you know what, Mr. Comptroller, who has his hands on the purse strings, you know that what's going to happen is if they decide to close it, they got to put those prisoners somewhere else.
Yeah.
You know, I went to private school just for a little while up on 110th Street, the new Lincoln School, which is now a prison.
Oh, wow.
And I'm wondering whether NIMBY won't rear its ugly head if, you know, you try to close Rikers and put those prisoners in more humane or other places.
Yeah.
Somebody's going to say on 96th Street or 110th Street or wherever, I don't want them here.
Yeah, well, that's happening down in Chinatown, you know, with same dynamics. So, yeah, that's exactly what's happening. And I think that's part of why the process has gone more slowly than, you know, the administration, the advocates would have wanted. It's obviously a very complex situation. There's no doubt about it.
And Letitia James is saying her office is examining its legal options. Legal options, of course, cost money, and you are the guy with your hand on the dollar for taking action at the troubled jail. How much would the state save or gain if it closed? I can't see how it's going to gain anything, can you?
Well, part of this gets into the discussion of criminal justice reform, and you saw that there have been changes even recently. Governor Hochul signed Less is More, if I'm remembering the correct title, to the latest iteration, and 190, I think, parolees were let out of Rikers. So I think part of what you're looking at from the cost point of view are really reexamining the length of sentences that people have, the parole system, alternatives to incarceration. So the prison population certainly is down. The question is how much further down can it be in a responsible way, right? You don't want to let folks out on the street that are going to cause mayhem and mischief. And there's a fair debate about, you know, whether some of the reforms that have been enacted in some cases have gone too far. Has the limitation of judicial discretion gone too far? You know, and I think this will be part of the debate in the state legislature next year in terms of whether or not any of that should be revisited. You saw some of that come up in the mayoral primary in New York City, you know, as a discussion point. So I think, you know, closing Rikers is not going to mean that there's not going to be a significant amount of money spent on housing prisoners. And hopefully if you're building new facilities, modern facilities, that'll be, again, safer for inmates and for correction people and staff that work there. It's probably going to cost more than what you've had already. So I think given the importance of this issue and how horrendous the situation is now, and I'll say this as the control, you should not just look at the dollars and cents. There clearly is a very troubling situation here that may actually require spending a bit more money for us to get it right. So I wouldn't be I wouldn't be stingy in terms of what the solution is. But some of the reforms that will continue on criminal justice, will save some money. I mean, the whole issue of older prisoners, people who, we did a report on this a couple of years ago of, those who serve long sentences and are in their senior years. Within the system, they cost a lot of money for the state. Why? Because they're older. They have more health care needs, medical needs. And at that point, in many cases, the recidivism rate for senior citizens who are in prison is very, very limited. And, certainly having a more thoughtful policy in terms of how to handle those folks would, I think, open up space, save money, be a more humane treatment for people who serve long sentences.
Of course, if the perpetrator killed your husband or your wife or your child and they were sentenced to life in prison, you wouldn't want to see them getting out because it was cheaper, right?
Look, no. I mean, you'd have to look at the category of the crime and, I'm not suggesting blanket 100% situations, but not everybody that's in prison is there because they've murdered somebody. But this is tough stuff. When people have been granted clemency or parole, I mean, very often, to your point, the surviving family members are often still alive and they don't have a sense of justice. I mean, look, in a very publicized situation, you and I remember well 1968, and you and I both had our hearts broken when Bobby Kennedy was killed, right? And I was shaken, frankly, when I didn't even know it was coming up as a factor that Sirhan would be recommended for, being let out. And you saw even within, the wonderful Kennedy family divisions in terms of how to approach this. So this is not easy stuff and does get, very sensitive and very emotional. But hey, to your earlier point, the situation at Rikers is not tolerable for the inmates, for the families of the inmates, or for the men and women who work there in corrections. They've got to do something very different.
Tom DiNapoli, we have reached that point in the program. We're at the one-minute rule. You have no more than
one minute
to talk about anything I ask you. Okay, redistricting. What do you make of the dueling maps that were released by the Republicans and Democrats last week? In other words, the drawing of the districts.
Alan, I was shocked that the maps were so different. I was shocked that there was a Democratic map and a Republican map and never the twain shall meet. I was absolutely shocked. That's been what reapportionment has been about. We'll see how this all plays out. Democrats generally have the upper hand in New York, unlike most other states, I might point out. So if there will be a Democratic advantage in terms of especially the congressional lines, I'm not going to cry because we're not getting any breaks for Democrats in all those red states that have Republican legislatures and Republican governors, which are many more than the blue state. So, that's my view. But nobody should be surprised by the different point of view.
There's your minute. Climate change. Do you support the Environmental Bond Act on the ballot?
Yes. Yeah, well, don't forget, the Bond Act is actually going to be voted on next year. This year is the constitutional amendment that talks about a right to a clean environment. And yes, I support that, and I will be supporting the Bond Act next year. And Governor Hochul has announced that she will increase the Bond Act from a $3 billion price tag to a $4 billion price tag, including more to deal with infrastructure, environmental infrastructure, and obviously climate change is a big issue for everyone. But yeah, I'm supporting the proposition this year, and I'll be supporting the Bond Act next year.
And from the Department of Good News, we're doing okay in terms of revenue coming in, aren't we?
Our August cash report, we're $5.9 billion ahead of projections based on the enacted budget. The updated financial plan from the new administration is anticipating at least $2 billion more in revenue this year and continuing over the next couple of years. The out-year budget gaps have been significantly narrowed. Combination of the economy coming back, as uneven as it is, but still coming back, increased taxes that were levied as part of the state budget on upper-income New Yorkers, big game changer still is the money coming from Washington, and if we get more money in the infrastructure bill, if they ever agree on that, it puts us in the short run in good shape. We have to be mindful of the out years. The federal money is not there forever. We should not spend all the money as though it's there forever. Let's build up our reserves. Let's focus on pay-as-you-go capital. Let's be smart and not assume that good times last forever because they do not.
Tom DiNapoli, what about raising taxes on the wealthy? Where are you on that one?
Well, we did it this year. I mean, that was done in New York State. And obviously, that's the big debate in Washington. And look, the split between Wall Street and Main Street is real. You have many folks that, in spite of COVID, have done very, very well. And certainly, the judgment was made in New York that they could pay a bit more. And so far, we're not seeing the tax collections on personal income tax go down. But we have to keep in mind, personal income tax tends to be a volatile revenue source. all the gloom and doom about everybody moving out of New York. It hasn't happened yet from what I've seen, but we need to look carefully and keep in mind, especially for people in New York City, where you have a city income tax. The combination of the city income tax and the state income tax, highest tax rate for those folks in the country. So it's great to say tax the rich, and we do that in New York more so than other places. You know, we have to be mindful that there's always a tipping point, and mobility, especially during you know, during this pandemic time, it's easy for people to live somewhere else and still do business in New York. And at the local level, Alan, I should mention this week we're putting out our updated fiscal stress scores for local governments. And we still got, you know, states in good shape, but we still have a number of local governments that are in some level of fiscal stress and certainly are not well positioned for some of the consequences of COVID, especially when the federal money is not there.
And now, as a result of COVID, as long as you're talking about it and have a minute, the controller's office, your office, upstate transportation authorities suffer revenue plunge. What's that about?
Well, you know, there's been a lot of talk about the MTA down in you know, the downstate region, but there hasn't been enough focus on the fact that the upstate, you know, public transit systems have suffered as well. So we put out a report to show how much of a drop they had in their ridership. And if that does not come back strongly, they're going to be in a precarious fiscal and budgetary situation. And so discussion in Washington or in Albany about how to prop up the MTA should not be separate from talking about upstate public transit as well. So we're really just trying to elevate the fact that the issue of public transit is more than just a New York City and New York City suburban issue. It is an upstate issue as well. For many people that may not have a car, that is their ticket and their ability to work and to do their daily business. So we cannot ignore the upstate transit systems.
And in 30 seconds, how's our pension fund doing?
Pension fund is doing great. 33% positive return. We're about $268 billion, and we are over 99% funded, Alan. One of the best funded, if not the best funded, pension plans in the country. And because of our strength, we've actually been able to lower the contribution rate for the next go around to our local government employers. That's good news for taxpayers. Retirement security is there for our retirees today and our future retirees. And this helps New York's finances to have a well-funded pension plan. So, and we're doing good things dealing with issues like climate and so many other issues with how we invest.
Okay, that's great. We are out of time. I just want to plead with you, Tom DiNapoli, that if you do hear anything as a result of this show and hear about the whereabouts of Madame Beerbaum, that you will let me know.
Bien sûr, monsieur.
We're out of time. Our guest has been New York State Controller, my friend, Tom DiNapoli. Controller, thanks so much for joining us. It's always a great pleasure.
Au revoir, mon ami.
Oui.